Hello, welcome to another episode of EMJ Live. This is Good Friday, 2025. As always on Good Friday, we attended the service held at the time of Christ's crucifixion, celebrating his crucifixion. This year, according to this liturgical cycle, it was according to the Gospel of St. John. And because we were reading the Gospel of St. John, the bishops, the United States bishops, have to put in a mandatory disclaimer here about the dangers of reading the Gospel of St. John. Passion narratives are proclaimed in full so that all see vividly the love of Christ for each person. In light of this, the crimes during the Passion of Christ cannot be attributed in either preaching or catechesis indiscriminately to all Jews of that time, nor Jews today. Okay, I get it. We get it. Why do you have to keep telling us this when it's obvious? All Jews at that time, of course, the Blessed Mother didn't cry, "Crucify him," did she? St. John, the beloved disciple, Mary Magdalene, and all the other disciples of Jesus Christ who were all Jews, who were hiding out of fear of the Jews, including St. Peter, the first pope, none of these people, all of them were Jews, and none of them cried out, "Crucify him." Why are we forced to listen to the obvious here? The Jewish people should not be referred to as though rejected or cursed, as if this followed from Scripture. No Catholic ever said that. I have never heard a Catholic say that Jews are cursed, implying some type of arbitrary thing like some voodoo doctor, putting bad juju on you by sticking a pin in it. Well, this is ridiculous. No Catholic ever said that. The church never ever keeps in mind that Jesus, his mother Mary, and the apostles all were Jewish. Duh. We don't deny that either. As the church has always held, Christ freely suffered his passion and death because of the sins of all, that all might be saved. Okay, so it wasn't Jews who killed Christ, it was sinners. I've heard many people make this claim. There's a problem here. There's a category mistake here. Let's do the Venn diagram. There is the big circle. That's sinners. Okay. Now, where does the circle Jews come in? According to the implication here, that's that circle over here. And there's no overlap between Jews and sinners. That's ridiculous. The Jew circle fits in its entirety into the sinner circle. Okay, you could say the same thing about Christians. The Christian circle fits entirely into the sinner circle. So it's a distraction to say, oh, it was sinners that killed Jesus Christ. It wasn't Jews. It was Jews. If you read the Gospel of St. John, it is clear that the Jews killed Christ. So once again, I feel obligated to give my response, in a sense, backing up what the bishops said, as I've already done, but by adding some clarifications and qualifications that they do not add in this disclaimer, which comes across in an incredibly arrogant, condescending way toward the Catholic people as if they're all idiots. No, you're being pressured by Jews to issue this condescending statement. Please don't treat us like idiots. Okay, in today's online daily readings, the USCBB, they keep changing it, introduces the gospel for Good Friday of the Lord's Passion with a disclaimer that reminds me of the warning on a pack of cigarettes. Warning, reading the Gospel of St. John may cause anti-Semitism. Its statement, the crimes during the Passion of Christ cannot be attributed in either preaching or catechesis indiscriminately to all Jews of that time, nor to Jews today, in no way invalidates the claim that the Jews killed Christ. The term the Jews or the Jewish people is not the same as all Jews. The Blessed Mother did not cry, "Crucify him," but the Jewish people did. Okay. Feel as if I've done my duty there, bringing a little bit of clarification to something that is annoyingly recurrent in our lives here. I'm tempted to ask the Jews, would you please issue a statement to the, your fellow Jews when they read the Talmud. Okay, Heinrich Graetz, the father of Jewish historiography, a German Jew, said the only thing Polish Jews ever learned from reading the Talmud was how to cheat people. So I propose a quid pro quo here. The Jews who are elder brothers should issue is put a warning on every copy of the Talmud saying, warning, reading the Talmud may cause you to cheat the Goyim. End of discussion. Okay, let's go to the next topic here.
But we have Liberation Day, as you know, on April 2nd.
No, there's no sound here. President Trump has
called Wednesday, April 2nd, Liberation Day. He calls it liberation from
all right, we're not going to run the whole thing.
In the U.S. markets just, and making there, sure that U.S. goods are what's being here? Purchased by consumers.
Okay, let's wait. Stop. Don't run that yet. I have to clarify that first clip. Okay, on April 2nd, Donald Trump declared what he was calling Independence Day by announcing the levying of tariffs, new tariffs, absolutely crushing tariffs, prohibitive tariffs, if you're talking about China, 145% tariff on Chinese goods. China is the biggest exporter of goods in the world right now. All of these have to pay 145% coming into America. Outrageous. This is not the way tariffs are done. Okay. Tariffs are generally reciprocal. There's a quid pro quo. And the tariffs, the responsibility for levying tariffs is with Congress, because Congress has to understand, take into account that there are going to be all kinds of implications for these things. Okay, unintended consequences, all kinds of stuff can happen when you do this type of stuff, especially if you do it recklessly, which is how it was done. So the immediate response was that the stock market tanked. It dropped 2,000 points within a matter of hours after the announcement. And this was not particularly good news. And so what was Donald Trump's reaction? Within 6 days, he took it all back. Okay, he revoked the tariffs that he just imposed 6 days before. I'm just kidding. We're not going to do it for another 90 days, or we're going to put it on pause for 90 days. But China, and he jacked up China's a little bit after that, just to rub salt in their wounds. We've gotten used to saying about Russia, don't poke the bear. Well, it's like now we need to say to China, about China, don't poke the dragon. This is really extreme when it comes to the idea of tariffs. Now, what are tariffs? They're a tax. They basically, what is the purpose of tariffs? It has all kinds of purposes. It's complicated. If you want to read my analysis of it and the good purpose that it served, you can go to the chapter on Friedrich List in Baron Metal, where I talk about the man who was instrumental in coming up with protective tariffs, both in the United States, where he visited the United States. He actually was working in Reading, Pennsylvania, for a newspaper called the Redinger Adler, the Reading Eagle, and got involved in business, was going to have found a coal seam, was going to exploit it, didn't work out. And he went back to Germany and he persuaded the German principalities at this point. There was no unified Germany at this point. To create first the Zollverein, the customs union, and then after that, the unification of Germany, basically abolishing all internal tariffs within Germany and putting external tariffs around Germany to protect it from pretty much one thing, which is English free trade, English exports, particularly cloth. The English had created the steam-driven spinning jenny, and then they had machines that would weave thread into cloth, and they could undercut, because they mechanized it in a especially dramatic way, they could undercut anyone's prices in the world. And so they were naturally in favor of free trade. Dishonestly, they were still protecting their own shipping and stuff like that. In a way that would wreck every single economy in the world that accepted it. One of the first major protest against this was Gandhi in India. If you remember Gandhi, he always brought a little spinning wheel around with him. Wasn't that he wanted to do things when he was bored. This was a symbol of his resistance, of Indian resistance against British imperialism. This was when Gandhi was trying to get the British out of India. This was the symbol. They had to come up with some type of independence, and they had to do that by producing their own cloth and stop buying cheap cotton cloth or dresses or whatever from England. Now, these principles have not gone away. So let's give our best shot, okay? Let's give the best shot to explain why tariffs are necessary. They were necessary to protect the fledgling manufacturing base of the United States of America. Alexander Hamilton accepted this. Friedrich List only seconded what Hamilton said. We cannot have, if you have an import of cheap goods, manufactured goods, you will destroy your manufacturing base. America was based on resistance. It was based on tariffs. Our good friend Nathaniel Hawthorne worked in the customs office in Salem, Massachusetts, and his job was basically to levy goods on in imports at a time when there was no income tax. This was the main source of revenue, and there's talk that Trump wants to bring it back in some way or other. Good luck, okay? This is not simply an idea that took place in the past. We've moved on. Now we're beyond that. We're into globalism. The best example I can give you of predatory free trade right now is East Africa. I was in East Africa. I've been to Kenya a number of times. I was had the privilege of being invited to Tanzania to work with by the Bishop of Musoma to write a biography of Julius Nyerere. And so the thing I notice, I'm traveling around the western part of Kenya, going from one little town to the other. The one thing I notice when you come into town, it's market day, and there are acres, it seems like acres, of used clothing. The Swahili word is mitumba. This is the mitumba market, and everybody's poking around in a pile of basically T-shirts. T-shirts are a curse on humanity, okay? Every day, a 20-ton ball of T-shirts rolls off the ship in Mombasa, gets broken up into 100-pound lots, and these guys go off and they sell it to the people in the Mutumba markets in the village, and they sell it at retail. This is a curse. I said that before. It's a curse on the economy. With 50 years ago, I met Silvano Barroso, who a Sicilian who was teaching at the Opus Dei Academy in Nairobi. He said that when he arrived in Kenya in the 1960s, you didn't go to a store and buy clothing. You went to a tailor, and the tailor made you clothing out of cloth that had been manufactured from cotton that was grown in Kenya. And this was the basis of an economy that was growing at that point. No, if you read Barron Metal, you'll see no advanced economy in the world could have gotten started without the production of cloth. Cloth is the basis for every big economy in the world. If you cut off the ability to make cloth, you are cutting off the ability of this economy to grow, and you're condemning the people in that economy to poverty. Okay, the Africans understood this. All of the East African governments at some point understood that Mutumba was killing the economy. There's no cotton being grown in Kenya anymore. No tailors to make shirts or suits. And they realized the cause of this is Mutumba, and so they banned it. Within, I don't know how long it took, I'm going to say, within 15 minutes, the Jewish rag pickers in New Jersey, Goodwill Industries, to name one of the names here, called up Secretary Mnuchin, another Jew, and told them, he's killing us. They can't do this to us. What are we supposed to do? A Jew must live, blah, blah, blah. Okay. Mnuchin immediately put sanctions on the East African countries, and the East African countries all backed down, except for one, Rwanda. The great Kagame stood up against it. And then next thing we know, oh, I'm sure it's pure coincidence, all these articles about the people in Rwanda complaining, crying crocodile tears about how they can't afford clothing anymore because of what Kagame did. Now, that's ridiculous, okay? The point is that Mutumba is a curse, and the only cure for this curse is tariffs. You have to put up tariffs. You have to block it. Otherwise, your economy will be a slave economy. That's just the beginning. It's also the basis of an ecological disaster. Okay, you bought that that rock final tour Led Zeppelin 1976, that black t-shirt, and you look so cool in it, you know what I mean? And then you got tired of it, and so you took it and you threw it in the Goodwill box. That t-shirt ended up in Africa. After it gets to Africa, there's no place farther down. It stays in Africa. And to give you an example of what happens then, you go to Ghana, and it goes into the ocean, and there is a 20-mile-long strand or filament of this disgusting combination of t-shirts that is drifting 20 miles out into the ocean, causing ecological damage because there's no place else to go. After it goes to Africa, that's it. So it's a bad thing. We should all meditate on the idea of what damage the t-shirt is doing, and try to do whatever we can to stop it, okay? And tariffs are absolutely necessary in all of Africa, I'd say, but certainly in East Africa right now. And the only reason that the Africans are not allowed to do this is American imperialism serving the interest of the Jewish rag pickers in New Jersey. That's wrong. Shouldn't do it. That's the strongest case I can make against tariffs. Okay, so what happened? How are we supposed to resolve this? There's a fundamental principle here. It is called the national economy. Our Heinrich Pesch, who is the intellectual basis of my book, Baron Metal, wrote a book, Das Lehrbuch der Nationalökonomie, the teaching guide for the national economy. If you don't have the sense of what a national economy is, you're not going to solve this problem. What do we mean by this? The goal of the economy is everyone in the nation state. The goal of the German economy is the good of the German people. The German people, all of them, are the purpose of that economy. Now, that doesn't mean everybody's going to get the same wage. No, I'm not saying that. I'm not a socialist. I'm not a communist. Calm down. I'm not a communist. Okay? But this is the goal of the economy. It's clear that this idea never caught on in America. And it's clear by listening to our illustrious president, Donald Trump. So, what happened? Draconian tariffs 6 days later, pulls them off. What happens when this happens? The first time he declares this, puts the tariff, the stock market drops 2,000 points. Now, what's going to happen when he revokes it? It's going to bounce up at least 2,000 points. And anybody who knew about that is going to make out like a bandit. Just betting, shorting the market, betting on the differential here. And that's exactly what happened. This is the antithesis of the national economy. This is the, what should I call it? The Jewish economy? The capitalist Jewish economy, which is based not on labor as the source of all value, but on gambling, okay, and usury. Okay, we talked about that and when I was talking about Las Vegas. So here's Donald Trump talking about what happened.
This is Charles Schwab. It's not just a company, it's actually an individual. And he made $2.5 billion today, and he made $900 million. He's in financials. I've always been
following. Okay, his rich friends got richer. I'm sorry. Okay, we have a disconnect here. The purpose of a tariff is to protect industry because labor is the source of all value, and you will never have a flourishing economy unless you promote labor. Here he's now switching into his other mode of the big New York mover and shaker who's running the economy so his rich friends can get richer by speculating on the stock market. Okay, this we gotta resolve this issue. So let me give you the other side of the story. Let's talk about bicycles. One of the most important events of my life was discovering how effective what we called a 10-speed bicycle was in getting you around through a city like Philadelphia, which we're going back to now 1971, which was clogged with traffic, polluted, clogged with traffic. The average, like in Manhattan, the average speed of the average car is 2 miles an hour. Maybe it's the bus. Maybe it's cars, 5 miles an hour, 2 miles an hour for a bus. It's not working, okay? And the bicycle was an incredible liberation for me. I had, in high school, I'd run 10 miles because I was on the cross country team, but I never thought, man, you can get on a bicycle and you're five times more efficient getting around on a bicycle than you are by running. And so that means basically all of your transportation problems, all of my transportation problems were solved. A lot of my financial problems were solved when I basically abandoned the car and moved to a bicycle. I could get around faster than I could by car. It didn't cost me $6,000 a year, which I could not afford at that time of my life. And I was healthier. I got exercise, whether I wanted to or not, because if I had to go somewhere, I had to get exercise. It was one of the best things that ever happened to me at a time when there was a boom. This was, in a sense, my generation. If you want to talk about the reality of my generation, as opposed to all using boomer as a cuss word, between 1971 and 1974, there was a huge boom in bicycles. Because a lot of people discovered what I discovered. It's a much more effective way of getting around than the car is. It's a lot cheaper. It's a lot better in every simple respect. And we rushed out and bought bicycles. Now, what kind of bicycle could you buy at this time? The main bicycle that was sold in America at this time was the Schwinn Varsity. Now, there it is. Okay, God bless the Schwinn Varsity. Look at this. This thing weighed 43 pounds. I don't know whether you know bicycles, but that's an incredibly heavy bicycle because Schwinn had gotten into the business during the 1950s of basically making toys. They had these, I don't know whether you have a picture of one of those, the Phantom, the Black Phantom. It was modeled on a car. It had kind of like a tank on it, which was supposed to be a gas tank, except there was nothing in it. Well, there were batteries in it for the headlight and so on and so forth. Okay. It's good. I guess kids loved it. I never had one. Okay. But it's a stupid bike. And then they got even stupider when they created something called the Stingray in the 1960s, which had what was known as a banana seat, which is this long seat. The point of a bicycle is the power comes from your leg. Your leg has to have maximum extension in order to exert full force on the pedal. And you cannot do that when you're sitting on a Stingray. So it's a completely impractical toy or piece of junk, depending on how you look at it. Okay. Now, when I got into the bicycle, I did not buy a Schwinn Varsity because there were better options available, and what I bought was a Peugeot. It's called the U08, the entry level model. It costs the same price as the Schwinn Varsity, which is to say $75. Okay, there was a top of the line Peugeot, which was called the PX10, which I did buy after I got this thing, and it was equivalent to the Schwinn Paramount, which was a good bicycle. There's no question that the Schwinn Paramount was a good bicycle. Okay, but the problem was the Schwinn Paramount cost $500. Now, it says something different. If you Google it, it says something, another price, $125. I don't believe it. I'm sorry, but I remember the figure $500. Okay, that's that was a lot of money then, especially compared to the top of the line Peugeot. Okay, now, which I think was 125? I can check the figures later on, but significantly lower. We had a similar situation with the automobile. Okay, Studebaker was the South Bend Automobile Company. They produced some really interesting looking cars, a great car called the Avanti, but they came out around this time with something called the Lark. Okay, the Lark, there's the Lark, that green thing, and it had a V8 engine. Now, why a compact car has a V8 engine, I don't know, but they had to have a V8 engine because that thing was really heavy. You needed a big frame. The chassis got bolted onto the frame. There was no unibody frame. That car cost $2,400, going head-to-head with the Volkswagen, which the list, if you go Google it, it says $1,500. I think my father bought a 63 Volkswagen for $1,300. So we're talking about roughly twice the price. So what role should tariffs play here? Should we have put a tariff, 135% tariff on the Volkswagen? Should we have put 135% tariff on the Peugeot or the Raleigh bicycles, which were also good? There were two kinds of bike. There was the Varsity, which was made out of lead pipe, I think. It certainly felt that way. Or you had Reynolds 531 tubing, which was the state of the art for decent bicycles at that point, cotterless cranks, and so on and so forth. I'm going to make a point. This is an open discussion. We can look at it both ways. Should we have protected the Lark? I'm not sure. Was that a good idea? Should we have protected the Varsity? I have a very definite answer to that. No. I think that the net result of the Varsity was that my generation got on that thing and rode it around the block and said, this is torture. I'm never going to ride another bicycle again. I think it destroyed what could have been a significant movement, which is exactly what happened in Holland with my generation at the same time. 1973, the oil boycott. I was in Germany at that point. Fahrverbot in Germany. You couldn't drive a car, and everybody loved it because the streets were free. The Dutch at this point decided that their cities were beautiful. We're not going to wreck our city to accommodate the automobile. The Dutch got on the bicycle, and they've been on the bicycle ever since. And they have solved their transportation problem, and they solved their oil. The fact that they have no oil in Holland, they don't need this big outlay of oil. We don't have to go to war with the Arabs because what's our oil doing under their sand? Who gave them the right to have that oil over there? That's our oil. All of this could have been avoided if we had made some sensible move at the same time that the Dutch did, which is basically preserving their city and coordinating bicycle with rail traffic without wrecking the heritage, the architectural heritage of Holland. That's my point. I'm not going to force any issue. I'm working on this right now. I may come to a different conclusion when I'm done, but that's the state of the art. That's my rant. Let's hear what you have to say.
All right, here we are. Hello once again. Voice of Mike Bajakis here, Dr. Jones' assistant. In these matters, welcome to the call-ins section of the show. Call-ins are made via our Telegram. Links can be in description wherever you may be. And then later in the stream, we're going to read off questions from the chat. So go ahead, type your questions however you please. Some quick rules for the chat here. Try to keep questions on subject. Be respectful of everyone's time. And whatever you do, do not forget to unmute yourself. I allow you to speak on my end, and then you have to press the unmute button on your end, and then you can talk there. I got to say it every time, because if I don't, someone's going to ask. Here we go. Let's go. Telegram, what do we got? First caller is going to be Butch. Mail Hot. Go ahead, Butch. Are you there?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay.
Okay, great. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah. Thanks for taking my call, Dr. Jones and Mike. Thanks for fixing the audio. I think this conversation around tariffs is, when I listen to other people talk about it, it's so myopic, and I'm glad that you're expanding the historical importance. But I think that what every American should understand is, and I want to get your thoughts on that, is that, you know, a lot of time has passed since Alexander Hamilton, and the tariff thing isn't some, you know, weird thing that Donald Trump just came up with to make the markets fluctuate so his rich Jewish friends, you know, get richer. This is, you know, it's a multi-factored philosophy change that we have to make as a country. And it really does go back to, I think, the point that you're making brilliantly in Bare Metal, is that the working, having a very effective and smart working class that's productive, which China built over the last 30 years, and you could see that they're really bearing the fruits of the labor. They can build cities in weeks. They can build entire cities. That's that amount of power and innovation is great for society. It makes wealth. And we have been slowly losing that. And all the promises that we had with free trade was that, you know, all the manufacturing, the jobs that Americans would not do would go overseas to slave labor, and then we'd be doing something more interesting. And that's not what happened. What we ended up doing is becoming people who borrow money from Chinese peasants through Federal Reserve to purchase products manufactured by those same peasants. And the peasant class in China, they don't get raises. They don't get incredible buying power. They're paid at the lowest wage levels. So there's no demand for them to buy any products built here because they don't have the money. It's like, you know, what was the buying power of a slave in the South, you know, before the Civil War?
Yeah.
So these tariffs.
Now that has changed. Yeah. I had lunch with a Chinese lady who announced to me that her salary was just double. The Chinese government is now starting to realize that you've got a billion people there. That's a lot of buying power. And as Pesh said, wages are income according to the big picture, according to the economy. They're not an expense, they're income. And so if you double the wage of these people, you're doubling the purchasing power. But it's all based on labor. You have to be able to mobilize labor. And the problem here is that when we exported the jobs, when we outsourced all this type of stuff, we killed off an entire generation that needed how to learn how to work. This is the problem.
Exactly. Yes. Like that's what is most exciting is one. Yeah. And that's exactly right. China's going to realize with these tariffs that they need consumers for all their product. We're the consumers. So now they have to create their own consumers, which they have to pay their own people more, which is good for us because now they're consumers and it's good for the Chinese people. And then we have to stop being just consumers. We have to learn to work and innovate and become more productive like we used to do before they moved all of the manufacturing overseas, because manufacturing is like you were just saying with cloth. It's like you start with manufacturing and then all the science and efficiency and all the activity that goes into optimizing manufacturing makes academics richer. It makes the eggheads richer. It makes the strong people who have to work in the factories smarter and more effective. It has a redounding effect on the society. And then people who go to work, especially men, it actually makes you a better person.
That's
it's
right.
So much better than sitting in your basement
Absolutely.
With pornography, the PlayStation, and
Absolutely.
Pot.
Yeah, the point is what forced me to work, what forced me to the labor force was getting married and then getting married and having a child. Yeah. Suddenly, hey, I'm the guy, everybody's depending on me, and that motivates me, and that's what drives the economy. But if you're going to have an economy where there's no jobs, where the jobs are all in China and your job is simply to sit in the basement and play video games, it's going to have a devastating effect on the entire country. Now, the question is, is Trump closing the barn door after the horse is out? And if the horse is out, is the horse ever going to come back again? This is a long, arduous, process of when I grew in Philadelphia, you know, they had a working class, they had a class of mechanics that were skilled and did things that it did all kinds of things. My wife's stepfather was an example of that, who could fix anything. This was what made wealth in Philadelphia. The same thing happened in Detroit. They had a group of skilled mechanics that were building ships, and Henry Ford walks in and says, okay, you're going to build automobiles, and I'm going to pay you a wage that will allow you to buy the car that you create. This is what created the wealth of the country. And we watched finding the beginning with the 80s, with the leverage buyouts of the 80s. And who was that group of people? The people that don't work and always speculate and gamble. The Boskys and Michael Milkins of the world, okay, they chopped up these factories, sold them off piecemeal. Paul Singer did this to Cabela in Nebraska, wrecked an entire town. Tucker Carlson did a video on this. And we've been promoting these people, and now they're taking over. And now they got to the point where they're so arrogant, they're not going to allow you to criticize them. You'll go to jail if they don't like what you say. This is all flowing from that shift from basically an economy which valued labor to an economy which is based on gambling and usury.
Yeah, yeah. And then the other problem is that I think that is that all the a lot of the high paying wage jobs are women oriented jobs in beauty and healthcare and all sorts of non tangible goods type services.
Yes, let me just say
that's happening.
Yeah. Let me just say at this point that one of the great tragedies that took place during this time was the abolition of the family wage, which Ford believed in. The father, this is the basis of a sound economy. The father must be able to earn enough to support his family without his wife working so that his wife can raise the children. That is the foundation. That's ground zero. You have to have the wage that high. That's what it was. I remember watching it disintegrate before my eyes. This big dude, he's making 70, 71. He's making $20 an hour working at credit. That was serious money. And what's he spending it on this chick that he's living with and expensive whiskey and stuff like that? This is what Playboy was created for, to basically take the family wage, give it to the man, and so he can piss it away on all these consumer items. This is the tragedy. The culmination of it was the feminist 1970s equal pay for equal work. And nobody knew how to deal with that. No, that's a bad idea. It's a family wage. That's the good idea. That's the basis for a sound economy.
Right. And the way we're doing it now is we're borrowing money, we're printing money, we're selling treasury bonds, and we're paying people to stay home with that money. No, it's not coming from taxes, really. It's really coming from the dollar that's being borrowed and inflated and printed. And then they're using that to buy cheap goods or whiskey or Playboy or wherever the hell they spend their money on. And we got to start making stuff again. And I don't see another way to start unless you start with a tariff barrier outside the country. That's the first step. And then you have to change your mindset that the worker and developing a productive worker is in your national interest. It's in society's interest. It's in the future's interest. That is the wealth of the nation, is the worker.
I agree. The question is, how do we bring it about? Okay. And the question, and tariffs are not a simple thing. Anyway, thanks for your comment.
Thank you. Bye.
All right. Thank you, Butch. We'll keep moving here. It's only wrong when white people do it. Go ahead.
Hey guys.
Well, quiet.
Hello.
Hello. You there?
Hey, doctor.
Yes.
Greetings. Blessings. Yeah, I have a question. I've had this one about the whole white thing. I think you're very interesting the way you deal with it, but I have a question. Basically, there seems to be two definitions of white, and you picked one. You focus on the one that's like, you know, skin color, and it's just like distinction between blacks and all that. There's another definition of white that is effectively European heritage. And so I wonder if that changes your assessment, where like when you concentric circles of identity, you know, you have your local family, you have your town, your neighborhood, your city, your state, your nation. And then in the broader scale, it's kind of your geographical continent area, culturally and ethnically and racially. don't you think that under that rubric, there is, we can respect the concept of sort of like continental heritage, European, white?
It's not white. No European is white. Never was, never will be. If you're talking about ethnicity in Europe, yeah, I'm a big supporter. I lived in Germany, speak fluent German. I'm half German, I'm half Irish. This is completely compatible with the Catholic Church, but it's not white. White is an American thing. White was created in Virginia to divide the working class. There were slaves from Africa. There were slaves from the Celtic slaves from Scotland and Ireland. White is a category of the mind that gets imposed on for people for political purposes. That's what it is. Ethnicity is a category of reality. It's the language you speak. It's that's when you're talking about heritage, that's what you're talking about. It's not whiteness. And,
okay. And so what word would you use to refer to the broader European diaspora other than white? What's a concise way to refer to that?
Well, American. The point here is the white is an American creation. That's what you're saying. They come over here. You can only have white when you have black. That was the situation in the colonies. Now, if you want to use that term, it has a lot of meaning in the South. It didn't have much, meaning much at all in the North until the blacks started arriving in ethnic neighborhoods, largely because of social engineering. So I'm saying that the white was always a way of fomenting conflict between people and then assuring that one group would have the upper hand in this conflict and continuing the conflict. I'm saying the same thing is happening right now. The resurgence of race serves the ruling class because it's always a form of division. If you're talking about Catholicism, that's a form of reconciliation. And I'm saying that that is the ethnic identity. There's always been problematic because the people who are Americans come from other places. And at a certain point that when they arrive here, they're Irish. And three generations later, their descendants are American. They lose the language and so on and so forth. This is the triple melting pot. I'm repeating myself here, but it seems to me that's the best explanation of ethnic identity in America. And whiteness does not cover it. Whiteness simply is a dead end. If you're talking about heritage, at a certain point, people got nervous about using the word white and they started talking about European heritage. European means German, French, Italian. These are all languages. They're all cultures based on ethnicity that's based on a language. And white has no meaning whatsoever in this context. White only has meaning when you have black people. If you want to create conflict in places like Ireland, flood it with black people. I guarantee you that's exactly what's happening. It's weaponized. The Jews are doing it. Ask Barbara Lander Spector, ask Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society. And the point is, I keep telling people, don't fall into this trap. It's a trap. If you start identifying as white because they're black people being forced into your neighborhood, you're going to lose that battle and you're going to lose your identity in the process.
Very well. Thank you so much.
You're welcome,
Dr. Jones. Blessings.
All right. Thank you for the question. Let's do one more here. Kind of a long monologue here, but and then we'll get the chats. So you guys start typing them in. Let's go. Last one is going to be MV. Go ahead, MV. Are you there? Oh, let's do it again. Are you there, MV?
Hey, Dr. Jones, building on that last question, if it's a trap for white people to fall into the identity of being white, is it also a trap for blacks to refer to themselves as black in America?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the man who understands this is Jason Whitlock. And this intemperate attack that Nick Fuentes launched on Jason Whitlock is calculated to cause division. So if you ask, what does it mean to be black? Does it mean you have to be a rapper? Does it mean you have to show 3 inches of underpants when you wear your baggy pants down around your, is this what it means? Who gets to dictate what black identity is? Well, the answer is very clear. It was the Jews, beginning with the Harlem Renaissance, when they created the black as the sexually liberated, happy-go-lucky, banjo playing, whatever you want to call it. It was the Spingarn brothers, and Amy Spingarn created Langston Hughes as this thing. Claude McKay, Home to Harlem. Well, this is all created for a certain purpose. Okay, and so what is Jason saying? Well, I'm a Christian. Oh, that's different, isn't it? And he's saying basically, no, I'm not going to allow these people, the people that control the media, to determine my identity. That's true for black people, and it's true for white people in slightly different ways. But yes, that's true. We have to stand up for our own identity, and we don't want to internalize the commands of our oppressors. And Jason Whitlock understands that.
That makes excellent sense. And to your point about tariffs and what have you, I think Trump is also at least giving lip service to building more jobs in America, but he has to know, being the businessman, that takes decades to rebuild what was destroyed in a couple of decades. Where do you think he's going to go with that? That's my last question.
Yeah, that's a good question. This is a super tanker that is really big, and it takes a really long time to turn this super tanker around. And so, okay, it's good that you're going after DEI. That's good. Okay, that's a good thing, because that wrecked whatever it had. We have to go even deeper. We have to get, you know, back to the family wage. This is alien to American thought. Americans think of themselves as individuals, and what you do is you fight with other individuals, you get the upper hand, and then you crush your opponent and you laugh all the way to the bank. That's what the Jews have done. They're on top now. We have a culture that doesn't represent the majority of the people in this country. It represents Jewish money, controls our Congress, controls the Ivy League now, it controls everything. And we have to stand up and say, no, that's not the American, because worse things are coming down the pike now. There are bills now that are in Congress and in the House that's going to make it illegal to criticize Jews. This is the Debbie Lipstadt. You bring a Jew in, you put the Jew in any position in government, and he immediately uses the government to punish people he doesn't like. Debbie Lipstadt. That bill that she did there, the anti-Semitism thing, Mr. Friedman attacking Candace Owen, okay, saying it's the law. We need the government to get involved in this. No, you don't. You don't have the right to arrogate the government to your particular ethnic group and use it to hurt everyone else. Merrick Garland, what he did to pro-life Catholics, caused abortions a fundamental Jewish value. This has to stop. Got to stop here. Otherwise, there's going to be something really bad as a reaction.
Thank you, Dr. Jones.
You're welcome. Let's ask, is Lloyd still there? He's all the way in Australia. He's probably, you know, he's up late. Ask him if he's got, let's see.
I'll let you speak, Lloyd, if you got a question for us, Lloyd? Maybe not. Are you there, Lloyd?
You probably scared him away.
Probably scared him away.
All right, let's go to the chat.
There he is.
Okay, Lloyd.
I don't have a question.
Oh, he's a little quiet. He doesn't have a question. He says,
I don't remember pressing the button.
fair enough. Fair enough, Lloyd.
Okay. Good to hear from you.
All right.
All right. Let's go to the written.
Yeah, let's go. Let's go to statements here. All right. Let's see. Rumble here. First question from Christians Praying. Where will the capital come from to begin to manufacture computers and cell phones? Americans have no capital, which comes from banks, back on depending upon Jews to get capital.
There are trillions of dollars. Trillions of dollars have been transferred from the lower class to the less than 1%, 1% of 1%. Trillions of dollars of income over the past 30 years have been transferred upward. Well, there's capital. That's capital. They got plenty of money. And if they're going to hoard their money, well, let's Trump is saying, we have tariffs, we don't need an income tax. I think that's a good idea. Income tax is a bad idea. It punishes the lower classes. It's getting worse and worse and worse. I have an alternative. Let's have a wealth tax. Don't charge the guy according to his income, because Warren Buffett only makes $30,000 a year. Let's charge him according to his wealth, and suddenly you will see the end of the deficit once that happens.
Next question from also retired. Is USA an informative/service economy, and who benefits from that?
Yeah, we have gotten away from manufacturing. We outsource manufacturing. I remember reading William Rusher, the publisher of National Review, saying, yeah, all the big guys are this. I think it's a good idea. Let's just outsource it to China. Let them do all the work. No, no, we have to work ourselves, because if we don't work, we don't create wealth. And if we don't have wealth, then we can't work. It's a vicious circle, and we're slipping in to end up, we're going to end up like East Africa. God bless East Africa, okay? But they never learned how to mobilize labor there, because it's a long, arduous task. And I've tried to explain that it was the Benedictines who taught the Germans how to work. Ora et labora is the motto of the Benedictines, and the Germans created the best workforce in the world, and now they're being destroyed as well by the same forces. So let's start working on it before it's too late.
From VW Manu on Cozy, neoliberal Jeffrey Sachs isn't a fan of Trump's tariffs. Does that speak in Trump's favor?
No, it's complicated. It's a complicated issue. I've tried to explain to you the purpose of tariffs is to protect the manufacturing base of the country, because labor is the source of all value. And if you don't produce anything, you'll never have any wealth. How do you restore that? Do you restore that by jumping in with both feet and slapping 145% tariff on China, which we sent all of our factories to them? Is that the way to do it? Or are we dealing with the personality of Donald Trump here, you know, who, God bless him, seems to been having second thoughts about nuking Iran? Well, God bless him. I'm glad you're having second thoughts. But is this, again, part of the strategy of this guy who just because, you know, threatens Armageddon if you don't do what I want? I mean, let me be perfectly honest with you. During that speech, when he said, yeah, I put those tariffs on there, and all of these countries, they're coming to kiss my ass. What kind of person is that? What kind of crude person is that that would say it? And though something as complicated as tariffs, something that we need to have an intelligent discussion about, for him to say something like that, it doesn't speak well of this guy.
Next question on Rumble, Dan T19. Dr. Jones, what level of tariffs should the U.S. have on China?
It should be reciprocal. There should be, look, let me read this to you. I was going to read it to you before. This is Heinrich Pesch. The end of his section on tariffs, he says, number one, these are the guidelines. To the extent that it is not possible to satisfy essential needs and complementary goods by one's own productive resources, the import of such goods must be assured. Okay, if you need it, then don't put tariffs on it. These include goods which are suited to preserving, improving, and opening up one's own productive resources in one's own country. Okay, you should not threaten the people with sanctions because they're trying to keep out Mutumba, okay? Because they don't need it. They need to start planting cotton. Number two, imports should be, as much as possible, be limited to raw materials, and further processing, which increases their value, should be restricted for domestic production. The import of goods which are harmful from a cultural point of view or which do damage from the economic point of view must not be tolerated in compensation for export privileges. So there's certain things that you should never import, okay? Three, for the natural surplus of one's own production, a smooth and profitable market abroad must be assured. We add, even if it is necessary to eventually make appropriate, required, and tolerable accommodations to nations where these goods would be imported. Okay, smooth is the key word here. Slapping 135% tariff is not smooth. Four, the export of goods must not take place except with safeguards for one's own productive resources, and it may only be promoted on that assumption. Okay, you have to preserve certain things in your economy. The British thought they could outsource food production, and it turns out World War I submarines, hey, that's a bad idea. Okay, For our part, we would add overall the economic drawing together of nations insofar as is possible without abandoning one's own national welfare is to be hailed and promoted as the basis for world peace. And where there are conflicting interests, even here, the attempt must be made to arrive at an equitable balance. You see what I'm saying? It's balance here. God, at another point in this book, Pesh says, God didn't put the same resources in the all over, distributed all over the world equally. Some countries have abundant resources in one area and nothing in another. Okay, so you can build a vineyard in Iceland. And you can spend a lot of money and you'll get crappy wine that's going to be really expensive. So stick to cod, okay? And in Portugal, you can the grapes just grow just like all by themselves. So stick to wine. You can exaggerate this. This was Ricardo said this. And the English then wanted to swap cloth for wine and cut France out of the question. And of course, you have to be sensitive here. It's not something like, you know, that. It's not that simple. And so we need this type of sophistication in dealing with something like tariffs. And that's not what we're getting now.
It's 5:15. Did you need to leave it on the dot? Or
let's have two more questions. Then we got to go.
Cool. From PSUMJ, Dr. Jones, could you tell us the true story of Rosa Parks?
Okay, after Brown versus School Board passes, the blacks down there got decided we're going to start what's known as the Civil Rights Movement, and we're going to challenge the segregation. And so they decided the buses were segregated in Alabama or Georgia, wherever it was. And they had this woman who they appointed her to be basically the lady who was going to go in. It's not as if she all of a sudden, all on her own, just one day, I'm going to sit in the front of the bus. No, it was orchestrated by people in New York. The whole thing was orchestrated. And the lady was ready up and she's pregnant. Okay. And she's not married. So we got to get rid of that lady. And then the lady who got the job was Rosa Parks. And the rest is history. So, you know, nice lady. I met with her in person. We had a little discussion together. Nice lady. But she was just a pawn in a much bigger game. And that's how it started.
All right. Last question of the night is going to be from St. Paul Enjoyer. Very topical. If Adam and Eve are cursed, why can't the Jews be?
If Adam and Eve are cursed.
I think he's talking about original sin or...
What is this word cursed? We're dealing with a semantic issue here. Why are we using the word curse? Curse is something sort of from the outside. If you want to talk about the mark of Cain, I think you might be able to use that term. Are Adam and Eve cursed? Is that the proper word to use for the fact that they are being punished for the sin of disobedience? Not sure that's the right word. When you bring it on yourself, I don't see that as a curse. Curse is from the outside. And you may or may not be responsible for the curse. And the curse is kind of arbitrary. And you've got some malevolent being out there who's trying to hurt you through this curse. That's not God.
Well, there you guys have it. Once again, this is EMJ Live. We're here every Friday at 5. If you happen to stumble on us, that's Eastern Standard Time. If you're not already, subscribe to Culture Wars magazine at culturewars.com. And then Dr. Jones' books, Barren Metal, mentioned a couple times. Big book, great book. Only be bought at fidelitypress.org. Subscribe to Telegram, Cozy, Gab, BitChute, all that. Rumble, definitely Rumble. We're doing well there. Keep liking the videos. Keep following us. Dr. Jones, final words.
Yes, we're now reaching the end of Lent. I have to say that I tried to practice what I preached. I tried my best to stop scrolling, and I succeeded to a large extent. It was not easy. It was not easy. And if someone as old as I am, who was grown up in an era when there didn't exist, this shows you how addictive this thing is and how important it is to keep it under control. So if you did, congratulations. As I said, stop scrolling and stop reading, and now we'll celebrate the end of Lent and with some type of sense of moral accomplishment. So thank you. Happy Easter.
Happy Easter. See you guys next week. God bless.